Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. As school prepares to start, we may soon hear something about the school board investigation into Superintendent Crystal Hill, who has been on paid leave for weeks. The deadline for members of the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization to reconsider their rejection of the I-77 toll lanes is approaching, and Mecklenburg County Commission Chair Mark Jarrell says they are standing pat.
We actually voted against the project from the very beginning. We have maintained the same position that we started with.
Meanwhile, one of the companies already in the pipeline to build and operate the lanes has been touting the eventuality to stockholders. So, the State Board of Elections makes new rules for absentee ballots to deal with how you seal multiple envelopes. It's very tricky, according to one Democrat on the board.
I think it's overly fastidious.
And move over cyclospora, make way for West Nile virus. It's all happening. Here to fill us in on those stories and more is Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics reporter. Joe Bruno reports for WSOC-TV. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And David Hodges is investigative reporter for WBTV. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with CMS. For weeks, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board has been conducting an investigation into Superintendent Crystal Hill, who they have placed on paid leave. That's all we know because that's all we've been told. Mecklenburg County Commission Chair Mark Jarrell was on this program on Wednesday, and I asked him, as the chair of the board that just gave CMS $699 million, what he knows.
I know what's been reported. I know that they're dealing with a personnel matter that, you know, does not allow me to be read in to the extent that they are read in. They are responsible for oversight, Mike. And so they're exercising that oversight authority, and we'll support them.
So, Joe, should we be surprised that the county commission's in the dark about the organization that is their largest line item on their budget?
I don't think we should be surprised because CMS is notoriously private, and then you add in the fact that this is a personnel issue. I do think Mark Jarrell will eventually know more about this investigation, but in its current stages, I'm not too shocked that he doesn't have a whole lot of information, or at least information that he could share to the media.
And we may all know something more. School Board Chair Stephanie Sneed says we are approaching the end of their investigation. She also says this deals, as you said, with personnel issues, which are generally never revealed. How much more about this, David, are we likely to know?
I think a lot of it's going to be determined by what the school board decides to release when this investigation is completed. I mean, it is costing taxpayers quite a lot of money, $275 an hour. I know that many of us here that are on this panel will be filing records requests and trying to get information as soon as we can when this wraps up. But until they come to a conclusion one way or another, we're likely to stay in the dark. That's additionally complicated by the fact by North Carolina's personnel records rules, which really don't allow us to get a whole lot of information unless somebody is terminated for cause, in which case we get a little bit more. But unfortunately, it could stay somewhat secret until we do a lot of digging on this.
So the school board went into closed session to discuss this for 3.5 hours this week. Joe, these boards often go into closed session to talk about personnel matters or issues surrounding contracts and things like that. But is 3.5 hours a long time? Is it the average time? Put it into context.
I think 3.5 hours is certainly a long time. If that was a meeting that happened in public and the public was waiting outside in the chamber for the meeting to resume, certainly that would be unusual. Typically, I think most closed sessions, when you're discussing a real estate transaction or maybe a major company coming to Charlotte, they are about an hour long. 3.5 hours is one of the longer ones. I believe that's how long the closed session was for Charlotte City Council back in 2020 when there was the kettling incident. So as you could see, like if it's an extended closed session like that, something serious is going on. So they were probably getting briefed by their attorneys on the status of the investigation, what they found so far, and what the next steps are, and maybe what their talks have been like with the superintendent thus far.
This investigation was announced on June 17th. It is ongoing, and the first day of school is set for August 25th. They say we'll know more. The investigation should wrap up soon. We're not sure what that means. How might Dr. Hill's absence in this run-up to the first day of school affect CMS?
I think lucky for CMS parents, they have a lot of experience with experiencing turmoil at the top position in the district. This isn't necessarily something new, that there are questions with who the superintendent is. All indications are the interim superintendent has, kept the train on the tracks and things are continuing to move. I don't think there will be a major impact to parents. I think that certainly they deserve answers, though. And I do believe the chairwoman when she says that there will be an update of some kind for everyone in the next couple of weeks.
We mentioned on this program last week that in December, this same school board that is now investigating Crystal Hill extended her contract and gave her a raise that was scheduled to begin when the state's budget was passed. That has happened. Do we know if that raise has kicked in, David, or how her contract or the extension of that contract might impact any payout that might be coming her way should the board decide to terminate their relationship with her?
I don't know the answer to that, Mike, but Joe's nodding his head. He might.
Yes, I do. So if they terminate her for cause, they don't owe her really anything other than like her typical paycheck and whatever and allowances she's entitled to. But if she is terminated for convenience, the school board just doesn't want her anymore. They see these findings from the attorney and they say, okay, well, there's nothing illegal here, but we still don't want her to come back. Then they owe her 1 year's pay. And as in terms of her contract and how that raise was built in, it just kind of said that as soon as the teachers get the raise from the budget, then your raise will kick in as well. So teachers, it's my understanding, have not received the pay increase yet. I think that's the next paycheck in August that they'll see that slight bump, or at least the retroactive bump. So it wouldn't surprise me if Dr. Hill's pay bump doesn't happen until next month as well.
So one more question, and I don't know whether this can be answered, but even if this investigation finds that she did little or nothing wrong and they exonerate her, is she likely to be able to continue as superintendent? In other words, has just the mere fact of this investigation poisoned the well?
Based on our reporting, all indications are that this is that Dr. Hill will not return as superintendent. That is what we reported last month, that she will soon be out. And this investigation is to determine whether it would be for cause or for convenience. Now, that is what our reporting indicated last June. I guess it is possible that people have a change of heart, but it would surprise me, and I would think it would surprise many people if Dr. Hill was in charge of CMS again at the beginning of the school year.
Okay, so let's turn our attention to another kerfuffle. The majority of the members of the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization, CARTPO for short, met last month and withdrew their support for the toll lanes on I-77 from Uptown to the state line because of pushback from area residents. But while the debate that led to that discussion was taking place, Alex, you report that the parent company of Cintra, which runs the northern lanes and which is in the running to do the same for the southern lanes, was already touting this project to investors. It almost sounded like it was a done deal, the way they were pushing it. How unusual is that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's super surprising that the company was telling investors that they had I-77 South planned as far as like part of their growth strategy. They are shortlisted. They're among four developers that are in the running. I did think it was a little surprising the level of confidence that they had presented. I think it's interesting how much they're banking on this project to support their growth and appease their shareholders. They also talked a lot about, just how much they're profiting on I-77 North. And one of the things that they presented on was how much they're benefiting from not having toll caps to the North, which has become a really controversial piece of this. I think a lot of people think that the opposition is just related to taking out a few dozen homes or going by historically Black neighborhoods. But there is also that opposition that's grown because people are just upset with the Northern tolls and how a company that's not local is profiting off this and the money is not going back into the community. So NCDOT has said that they are going to have caps to the south when if that project moves forward, so as to not repeat those same mistakes. But I'm definitely going to be paying more attention to what that actually means and what those caps are, because obviously that's of something that's very much value to Cintra.
We're going to come back to all of that in the next few minutes. Cintra's parent company is called, I hope I say this correct, because I think it's a Spanish company, Ferrovial. They were the ones talking up these future lanes to shareholders or potential investors. Steve, Cintra has been reported to be on the short list of companies, as Alex said, that might win this contract to build and operate these lanes. They already operate the northern lanes. Do state decision makers have a favorable impression of how this company has operated those lanes? From what you can tell, have they done a good job?
I think the state feels, that Cintra has done a good job, but I think the state has kind of grudgingly admitted that the contract that they put in place with Cintra a decade ago was not the best. Because speaking to what Alex said, there are no caps. And Cintra kind of brags about that on its message to investors that, look, we negotiated a deal where we can set the rates as high as we want. And the DOT has said, hey, moving forward, if we do I-77 South, we are going to put in some kind of guardrail against that. But again, I mean, you know, Cintra is in business to make money. They negotiated a really good contract for themselves on I-77 North. And they are executing it. And as Alex reported, they're making a ton of money. They're about to hit $500 million in revenue since the thing opened in 2019.
And talk to me about what they do, because the toll, there's no toll booth. It's done electronically. If you have a pass, or if you don't, they take a picture of your license plate and your bill through NC Quick Pass, which is part of a nationwide network of toll road thing. What exactly do they do? Cintra.
Well, yeah, they have to maintain the lanes, like fix any potholes, damage to the lanes. They are responsible for managing that tolling system that you mentioned. They've got overhead.
Nobody's ever in those lanes. So what potholes could be created?
Future potholes. How about that? Future potholes.
So if somebody takes out a bollard or like one of those Jersey barriers, they have to fix that. If there's a crash in the lanes, they're responding to it. Guy gets a flat tire, they're responding. And, you know, they're making tons of money, like Steve said. Keep in mind, the price you see on the board when you're on those lanes is the price you pay if you have a transponder. If you don't have a transponder, you're paying 50% more. So when you see that $7 toll, it's actually 10 or, right. You know, 11, whatever the math is, because you don't have that transponder.
And I think the same question is, why are home builders now building homes for rent? Because there's a lot, you put up money up front, and then there's a lot of money you can make down the line. So that's the investment that's there for them. Put the money up now, make money forever moving, well, hopefully not forever.
This raises a whole bunch of questions, which I want to get to. I'm short on time. I have 30 seconds, Alex. Cintra operates these lanes in other parts of the country too, and you report that their parent company told investors that Charlotte was one of the top performing regions in their service area. How did you uncover that information? 20 seconds.
That was one of the slides in their presentation. So they are definitely betting on our traffic and this continued congestion. One of the stats that they shared with their shareholders was that Charlotte's population will grow 50% from 2025 to 2050.
So when we come back, more to talk about with these toll lanes, about the caps, about profits, and about if they're so profitable, why in the state building these roads? We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison's with us, WFAE News politics and transportation reporter, quite honestly. Joe Bruno's here, who reports for WSOC-TV. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. And David Hodges is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Alex, you also report this week about these toll lanes, that, and you've referred to this already this morning, that on these existing lanes, there is no cap on how high the tolls can be at any given time. But on the southern lanes, whoever operates them, the plan is to put caps on those rates. NCDOT made that decision. Why?
I'm not sure why they did it to the north, because that does predate me, but I think that they've now accepted that that has to be implemented to the south, or else people are not, I mean, people already are against this project, but that would definitely make people against this project if they didn't give that guarantee. Another thing that they've also said they would implement that's interesting, on I-77 South, they say that they want to have a discount program for low-income residents. The developer would be required to implement that and operate or maintain it, I believe, but we also don't know the details of that. I think that's something they'd have to negotiate.
I was going to say, how are they going to do that? I guess the transponder would know somehow that you're a low-income resident, or your license plate would be registered as such. How would they do that?
I'm assuming possibly okay. You qualify with your license plate.
Joe, how did you want to chime in here?
Just like thinking back to the northern tolls back in the day, what Cintra was stressing at the time was that the tolls will only cost you between 14 and 40 cents per mile. And whenever the northern toll opponents would raise concerns, being like, you're going to spend $20 just to go one way, they said, people aren't going to be using the lanes the whole way. You know, the prices are going to be varied, but based on the traffic and what time of day it is, we really don't think that will be much of a concern. And obviously now you're spending $10, $15 to go a couple miles. So their concerns did come to fruition, but there wasn't a debate at the time over whether they should put in that cap.
So they are making money hand over fist. Alex says the company reported $130 million in revenue from the northern lanes in 2025 and $52 million in dividends. But they built those lanes, did they not? They paid to build those lanes, and it cost them $4 billion to do that. Is that a good return on investment? Does anybody know? Steve is saying no.
No, the I-77 North toll lanes were only about $600 million, Joe, I think. Is that right? I mean, it was much, much less. And they also got some state subsidies. So the public put some money into that project. But again, about $500 million Cintra spent, and they've already made about $500 million in year seven.
So Steve, explain this to me. I mean, if we've already kicked money in for the northern lanes, are we kicking money in for the southern lanes if this happens?
Yeah, the plan would be $600 million plus $100 million for nearby roads.
And plus, we've already spent $60 million on the design. So if good money is flowing into these northern toll lanes to the point where there is sufficient return on investment that the company believes it can be successful if they add on to that the southern lanes, why wouldn't this be a great way for the state to increase their own revenues by building and operating these toll lanes themselves? What am I missing?
Yeah, a couple years ago, I asked the DOT that question repeatedly. You know, the idea was that there's the 77 North toll lanes are a proven moneymaker. If Cintra or whatever company builds it, they're going to go to the private markets and borrow that money. Why can't the state? The state does borrow money for roads. And I never really got a clear answer as to why the state couldn't do it on its own. I don't really know if anyone's ever gotten an answer.
Is the answer perhaps in following the money? I mean, in other words, if it's so profitable and they want to give it to an outside company, that it's a foreign company, in fact, is there some quid pro quo someplace?
I don't know. We can get into all that on this program right now, Mike. But what NCDOT will say, and that's a really good point about the borrowing aspect that Steve just raised, but what they will say is that the Southern project is going to cost $4 billion. And NCDOT does not have $4 billion to dedicate to the project in the region. And also, I think state law says the most a specific project can get is $600 million. Now, there are different things you could do to tap into, to separate the project in different segments. Steve's reported on this to get more money. But they're just going to say that, you know, it would be wild for the state to put $4 billion up front to build this thing.
So I played a clip of County Commission Chair Mark Durrell at the top of the program talking about how the county opposed these new toll lanes from the start and did not plan to alter their position. He has also said that he would never be in favor of a project that benefits those passing through Charlotte at the expense of those people living here. And he pointed out to what he sees as a fundamental unfairness with the existing lanes that he would not want to see duplicated.
There's a parking lot on one side and there's a wide open lane that costs you $30, $40. So that's addressing convenience for those that can afford it.
So Alex, is that why NCDOT says whoever gets the contract would be required to implement a discount program for low income residents? Is that why?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think we're not really, we keep saying we're going to relieve congestion with these, and that's not what's happening. We're just creating another option that you can pay for if you don't want to be in traffic. So I think that this low-income program is one way to maybe try to change the narrative on that. Well, you guys also have this opportunity because we're going to give you this program, but at this point, we don't have any details. And that's kind of the issue with this whole project, is a lot of this, we don't have details on all these things, and we're being asked to accept it and just keep moving forward. And that's why now we're the community is or the local governments who oppose this may be stuck with this $60 million plus dollar check.
Is the fact that we don't have a lot of the details deliberate?
It could be partly deliberate. It could just be partly timing. They might not have all these things. Like if they need to pick a developer and negotiate with them on the a low-income program or a toll rate cap, maybe they can't do that right away. There's no contract yet.
I mean, I know to Alex's reporting, it's wild that this company, Rovial, was bragging about how much money it could make from this project, but they supposedly didn't have any contract yet. So there's a lot that's still up in the air on this. I mean, up in the air that it's not even planning on moving forward right now.
And like the week after City Council pulled the plug on the project, the four developers were supposed to meet with the community in that little room outside of I-77 and share with them their initial thoughts and ideas and get feedback to hear directly from the community. That meeting never happened because the project died before that.
I think Steve wanted to get in, Les. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to say one of the key big plot points in this story now is that the DOT last week was in Charlotte, held private meetings with community leaders on the west side. They are still trying to find a way to get the community to back the toll lane. Once you do that, then you can put pressure on Charlotte City Council, one or two people to flip. So the DOT is still really working this project. They are promising more community benefits. We don't know what those are, I've asked, but there's a lot of positioning behind the scenes to try and keep this thing moving forward.
Well, that was my next question, because the deadline set by NCDOT for a decision is October the 5th, and I know that CARTPO is meeting sometime in September to talk about this. What are you hearing about which way the wind is blowing?
Well, you have four key members on CARTPO: the City of Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, Matthews, and Davidson. They all have to hold strong if you don't want to have the toll lanes. And as you heard from Commissioner Durrell, the county seems to not be changing its position. The DOT is really working on activists to try and flip someone on Charlotte City Council. Then, of course, you've got Matthews and Davidson, who have the potential to pay a big fine. They're these little towns. They can't do that. So you're going to, you know, someone in Charlotte is going to have to kind of create a coalition and a plan that all four can move forward together. But again, it may not even get to that point if the DOT is able to flip one or two council members.
Can any members of CARTPO, can CARTPO itself say, okay, we'll change our minds about this, we'll support this project, but here are the changes we have to have? Is it too late to do that?
I think they could negotiate a lot.
That's kind of the direction that they were going in. I mean, it is theoretically possible that this could get back on track without the city of Charlotte, but that's extremely, extremely unlikely. This really could all hinge on whether one Charlotte city council member decides to change their vote or not.
Well, yeah, we have our vote is worth 42%, I think, of the weighted vote on that CARTBO organization. Okay, so the North Carolina Board of Elections this week approved new rules for absentee mail ballots. What was the impetus for this, Steve? Why did they do this?
The impetus is really that Republicans now control the Board of Elections because it's under the state auditor's office and they have the power. That's one part. And the other part is that President Trump has continued to make claims about election fraud without any evidence. And so the Republican board is tightening the rules on how we vote. The week before, they changed the rules on photo ID. One of the key things now, under the previous rules, it took a unanimous decision of a local county board to reject a ballot. That means you had to have members of both parties agree that a ballot should not count. Now it's just a simple majority. So three Republicans can say, we don't think this questionable ballot should count. Two Democrats can oppose and it will still be rejected. That's kind of the backstory. The rules on mail voting this week were really in the weeds. You know, you have to, it's hard to vote by mail. There's a lot of steps to follow. If you don't fully seal the envelope that your ballot is in, but you seal the outside envelope, right? The one that the post office sees, that is grounds for rejection now. So it's, and this is a bigger deal because a lot more Democrats now vote by mail than Republicans. So this actually does have the impact, the potential to have more of a partisan impact, even more than photo ID.
So to be clear, this change says that you have to seal your ballot in an envelope and put that envelope in an outside envelope and seal it too. And if you don't seal the inner envelope, they can reject the ballot. This is one of the reasons that Democrats are against this. This is Siobhan Millen, who's a Democratic member of the Board of Elections.
If they don't understand which envelope they were supposed to put it in, but they put it in the sealed envelope, I think it's overly fastidious to throw their ballot out. And I think we're going to lose perfectly sound ballots due to overly fussiness.
Well, of course we are. And you spoke with Republicans on the board. They don't find the rules fussy or picky or difficult to follow. Are the instructions clear?
I think they're clear, but there are a lot of instructions. And it's difficult. North Carolina is a pretty, has high security for its mail ballots. And that, in a lot of ways, goes back to the 2018 election, you know, the mail ballot scandal in Bladen County. So there's just, if you follow the instructions, you can do it. But there are a lot of instructions and there's a lot of ways to mess it up.
So Republican board member Stacey Eggers says that an unsealed envelope is a security risk. And that would be true if we're talking about the outer envelope. But how is an inner envelope inside a sealed envelope a security risk? Explain that. Can anybody explain that?
I think my explanation, if I were thinking that through, would be that you're voting at home and you have your ballot out, but you haven't sealed it and it's lying around your house and someone else can come in and change your vote or vote for you. I think that would be the explanation that you would, you know, that it's available to other people. And like you said, Mike, in the past, you could have an envelope that was like not fully sealed or unsealed, and the elections board would likely still count it. Not anymore.
The reasons given for this and all these other moves that are being made by Republicans is to make elections safer and to improve election integrity, for which there is no evidence that they're not honest and fair. But is a pattern beginning to emerge here that the real reason for all this is to make it more difficult to vote, and specifically more difficult for those who might not vote Republican to vote?
I think that the mail ballot rules, like I said earlier, are going to impact Democrats more. It used to be 20 years ago that more Republicans voted by mail. Very few people did. Now there's been a huge change. Many more Democrats and Republicans vote by mail. So when we play this, these new rules out, whether they're in place for November or 2028, you probably will see a disproportionate number of Democrats who have their ballots rejected.
Okay. The late South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham's sister, Darlene Graham Nordone, was named, as we know, last week by Governor Henry McMaster to fill out the remainder of her brother's term. But he was up for re-election, and with only a week under her belt, she has decided to run in the midterms.
I feel like I can do it. I feel an inner peace about it.
Senator Nordone speaking on Monday with Fox News host Sean Hannity. She may have inner peace, but is this decision sending a shudder through the others who might be or have already announced that they're in this race? How are they feeling about this, Joe?
Well, I think the hardest part for Senator Graham will be introducing herself to voters, because 2 weeks ago, she wasn't on anyone's radar. Now she is serving as U.S. Senator for South Carolina, and she has to run in an election in 3 weeks. And we really don't know her positions on anything at this point, because rightfully she's been grieving. She probably doesn't know where the bathrooms are yet in the Capitol. She's getting her feet wet, and it's going to be a sprint primary. The thing that benefits her that she's going to have a lot of help, especially now that she has the president's endorsement. She is going to get some help when she's going up against some of these Republicans who can self-finance their campaigns.
You spoke with a couple of voters, one of them, Anthony Baker, about her. He's a Rock Hill voter.
She is purely just related to Lindsey Graham, has no background in politics or even any opinions from what I've seen.
Don't know if he's in the majority or in the minority in terms of what people in South Carolina feel about her, but she is up against, we know this, Rock Hill's Ralph Norman, who was in Congress, is in Congress, and Chesterfield Congressman Russell Fry, who I believe had Trump's endorsement before Darlene became a senator. So is he popular, Mr. Fry?
Yeah, so I read the New York Times article this morning that provided some more behind-the-scenes looks at how exactly that went down. Trump has always loved Russell Fry because Russell Fry defeated a congressman who voted to impeach him. And so he was planning on backing him, but Henry McMaster suggested Darlene. He talked to Darlene, fell in love with her, and endorsed her.
One more question about all this when we come back, and then we'll move on to the Cooper Whatley race in North Carolina. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Stephen Harrison is with us, our politics reporter at WFAE News. David Hodges is an investigative reporter at WBTV. Alexandra Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. And Joe Bruno is with us from WSOC. TV. One final question about Senator Nordone, who is Lindsey Graham's sister, who is now a senator taking his seat on the interim and running, we are told, at least in the Republican primary, in August. Early voting is set to begin August 5th. The main election is August 11th. As you said, Joe, we don't know anything about where she stands on the issues. We do know that she's been working with those with disabilities, particularly with the blind, and evidently, by all reports, doing an excellent job. And she has said that she is focusing on what she calls her ongoing fight for justice. Do we have any idea what she's referring to?
From what I've read about her is she's going to be more in tune with affordability issues and more kitchen table problems that South Carolinians deal with. Lindsey Graham, of course, was a hawk, and he was Mr. Foreign Policy. I think that she probably, and this I don't know for a fact, I think she's of the similar mindset of her brother, but maybe it will not be as, you know, prevalent in her everyday life.
Speaking of Senate races, both North Carolina candidates running for Tom Tillis' seat were in Gastonia this week. Were Republican Michael Whatley and Democrat Roy Cooper at the same place at the same time, or were these different events? Joe.
these were different events. It would be some nice, fun chaos to witness if that actually happened.
Michael Whatley spoke at an air tank manufacturer and went after Cooper, accusing him of making things cost more while he was governor.
I mean, Roy Cooper made stuff cost more. You look at what that guy did over the course of his tenure, electricity rates, 30% higher, housing costs, 85% higher, insurance rates.
So he flipped the script on Cooper, who had been hammering the slogan, has been hammering the slogan, make stuff cost less at every opportunity on the campaign trail, trying to tie Whatley to the man who endorsed him, Donald Trump. And tying Whatley to Trump continued when Cooper spoke in Gastonia.
The problem with Michael Whatley is that he will do and say whatever this president tells him to do and say, regardless of whether it's good for North Carolina.
So, Steve, were they both appearing in front of friendly crowds? Are they moving the needle in any way?
Definitely in front of friendly crowds. These events are pretty tightly controlled. They're, you know, just really elaborate photo ops. I think for Governor Cooper, he is ahead. The national mood favors him. So his make things cost less tour, you know, he doesn't really need to do a lot in this race. Michael Whatley, on the other hand, you know, he's behind in many polls by near double digits. I thought the interesting thing in his event was it was a 25-minute event, and during the prepared marks portion, President Trump's name was only mentioned twice. And usually in the past, Michael Whatley would talk about Trump all the time. Yeah. And I think Trump's horrid approval ratings have really caused Michael Whatley. He's not distancing himself from any of Trump's policies, but he's just not talking about the president much anymore.
So Michael Whatley, who was the former head of the GOP, both in the state and nationally, he mentioned several things that cost more as a result of Roy Cooper being governor. Any truth to the statements?
Yeah, I mean, Joe, you go ahead.
Things cost more. It's like, who do you blame, though? You know, you have a Republican General Assembly. Roy Cooper was governor. Do you blame the president, Joe Biden? Do you blame Donald Trump now that things cost more? So I think a lot of the claims that have been thrown out by both of them yesterday kind of have to dig in a little deeper to find out what the actual truth is. But there are a number of people you could blame for things cost rising.
Seems to me that all these people running for Senate and for Congress should just come out and say, I'm running for the retirement plan and the benefits, because they're not talking about doing anything when they get there, at least if past is prologue. Decent people nationwide have been horrified and disgusted with how ICE agents have conducted themselves. But two Charlotte mothers are pushing back as the result of what happened to them here last fall during Operation Charlotte's Web. They have filed claims for damages against the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. What are they alleging, Joe?
So they were on their way to the Southern Christmas show when they said that they saw a car that appeared to be Border Patrol agents during Operation Charlotte's Web. So they followed the car, and they were one of many people who, you know, when they discovered it was immigration agents, started blowing whistles, honking horns, letting people know that agents were nearby. And that, according to their filing, angered Border Patrol, and they confronted them aggressively and said, you have to leave. What things get hazy here is they left, but they said that they saw more Border Patrol agents, and they, when they left and tried to like get away from those agents, that the agents followed them, and they made a wrong turn down a dead end street, and they came to a stop in a driveway. And that's when we have seen the video that a neighbor recorded of those agents putting a gun to the window, breaking the glass of the window, and confronting the two women, the two mothers in this scene. So they're saying it's very traumatic. There was no reason for them to use that force, and they're seeking $2.5 million.
And here's how Jake Sussman, the chief counsel with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, described his client's experience to WBTV.
Over the course of hours, experience being threatened, being chased, being assaulted with guns being pointed at them, being zip-tied, handcuffed, detained for hours.
And David, they, unlike many others, were set free. How do they manage that?
I mean, this is a common theme that we saw after Border Patrol left Charlotte and Operations Charlotte's Web, where citizens who were chased by either ICE or Border Patrol and literally caught on video, U.S. Attorney's Office ended up dismissing those cases. If that's any indication that these women might have a solid case, I think you could read into that a little bit. So there are no criminal charges that are still pending against them. And I think that's a big part of the claim that they're going to be making going forward, because they didn't do anything wrong.
Each of them are seeking $1.2 million in damages plus attorney's fees. So that's about $2.5 million, as Joe said. They have filed claims for damages. If the federal government doesn't respond in, I think, 90 days, they can then go on to file lawsuits. Why don't they just start with the lawsuits, Joe?
There's something called the Federal Tort Claims Act, and this is the process that they have to go through.
Okay. We're going to bring Zachary Turner into the conversation. He's WFAE's climate reporter. Duke Energy Carolinas has been in the process of asking the North Carolina Utilities Commission for permission to raise rates. But last Friday, they lowered what they were asking for. Zach, what were they asking for?
Yeah, this is actually the second time that they've done this. Originally, I believe that they were asking for 10.95% for their rate of returns. This is the rate at which Duke Energy is earning returns on their investments in capital projects like building new power plants. They first walked it back, I think, about a month ago, when they, during their rebuttal testimony, to 10.48%, and now they've gone ahead and lowered it to below what it currently is at 10.1% to 9.8%. All of this means that we're still going to, you know, if this settlement is approved, we're still going to experience some rate increases. They'll just be a lot less severe than they would have been otherwise.
At a meeting with the Duke Energy, Utilities Commissioner Donald Vandervaart asked Duke Energy Carolina President Kendall Bowman about the decision they reached to lower the ask.
Is that what you told us a little while ago, that you all, out of the goodness of your heart, reduced a number from a rate that was higher than you were constitutionally entitled to?
We made the difficult decision, listening and hearing from our customers, to do something unprecedented, to bring down the ask.
So was he surprised by the move? Is that why he asked the question? He didn't quite believe it. He wanted to hear it again. Or was he just trying to underline the unprecedented nature of this?
No, it begs the question. So Duke originally said we need this 10.98% rate of return so that we can get favorable terms on our investments. And this is their argument, that this will in turn save money for our ratepayers. But then on their own volition, after Kendall Bowman stated they received an outpouring of customer concerns about rates going up, they said they're lowering it down to, like, they're halving their rate of return request. So what Vandervaart was getting at was this question that a lot of folks that were involved in this case had, which is, if you could lower your rate of return request and save customers money, why didn't you just lead with the lower number to begin with?
To be clear, Duke Energy reported $4.9 billion in profit last year. That's up $400 million from 2024. I'm just curious why they need the rate increase.
Yeah, I think their argument is that they need to increase the, one, it's to recover the cost of building new infrastructure to serve customers, whether it's residential customers or industrial customers. They also want to increase these rates of returns again to help finance some of these bigger projects. They've got a lot of new large load customers like data centers that are forecast to come to the state. And they say in order to keep up with those capital investments, they need to increase rates.
And under this agreement, if I'm correct, it calls for continued discussions for the creation of these so-called large load tariffs, which could potentially apply a separate power bill rate, essentially, for big users of electricity, like data centers. And people are all up in arms about data centers because they cause electric rates to rise for everybody. If the utility is responding to pushback over rate increases, are they likely to respond to the pushback we're witnessing from citizens about what happens when data centers come in and raise electric rates?
I think that's what's happening right now. The discussion about large load tariffs, this chance that we're going to see a new proceeding open up about starting a new large load tariff is a reaction to customer concerns as well as business concerns about what these data centers will mean for electrical costs for all customers. This represents another big about face for Duke, who had previously been of the mind that their current contracts, their current way of doing business was sufficient to handle these data centers coming to the state. But now they're saying we would like to increase our transparency by potentially adding this new large load tariff.
Meanwhile, something new is coming to Lake Norman. More housing for fish. the conservation nonprofit Lake Norman Wildlife, with grant money from Duke Energy, is building.
It's still a Duke Energy story.
That's right. They're building two artificial reefs. How are they doing this? What are they doing?
So, this is the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. They got a grant from Duke Energy. Duke gives these grants out because it's part of their licensing agreement for all of their dams along the Catawba Wateree. They help fund these habitat enhancement projects. North Carolina Wildlife Federation has contracted to get these 3D printed. They kind of look like Minecraft blocks that they're setting in the water to build these artificial reefs that are supposed to promote fish habitat. I think as one of the one of the folks at Wildlife Federation stated, they're trying to have fishers do more catching and less fishing with these reefs.
Yeah, that's right. This is really to help fishermen because it increases the population of fish around those reefs. I only have one final question for you, Zach, because we know that Lake Norman is a high rent district. Will this be affordable housing for the fish?
I guess so. I mean, it comes with a catch, I'll say.
Okay. Thank you. Zach Turner is WFAE's climate reporter. Very quickly, the Panthers revealed stadium renovations this week and revealed the fact that David Tepper's sports organization is kicking in even more money than previously advertised. Originally, the city was kicking in $650 million of, I think, $1.2 million in. Help me out here. What was the original agreement? How is David Tepper changing it?
It was like 650, 800 or 650, 650. Now it is 650 from the city and 1.3 billion from Tepper Sports and Entertainment.
And from the pictures I've seen, this is like a new stadium. I mean, it's going to be completely different looking for everybody. Inside,
it's really
out.
Cool. There's a lot of great stuff. Every fan will see something different. It's not just the high rollers who will be in the club levels. Everyone's getting new seats. I think the standing room only section is really neat. I think that will be popular with people. It's going to have a great view of the skyline. And I also like a lot of the things they're doing outside the stadium with like the stage near the south gate. Well, it'll be cool for tailgating. And the performance venue is something we don't have in Charlotte right now. And it'll attract more shows for people who don't like sports.
Yeah, the outside looks completely different, and their goal was to make sure that everybody benefited from these alterations. This begins when and will be complete when?
It's already underway. There is some back of the house stuff going on now. The fans will start to see construction in 2027. The performance venue will open in 2029. That's the concert venue, and the stadium project will be finished by 2030.
The number of cases of cyclosporiasis, which causes severe diarrhea, is on the rise in much of the country. At last report, there were 561 cases in our state, 29 in Mecklenburg County, 1 in Cabarrus. Federal health officials say that they have isolated the outbreak to iceberg lettuce grown on a farm in Mexico, but other produce may also be involved. And yesterday, we spoke with Cabarrus Health Alliance Medical Director Dr. Megan Easterday, who shared some interesting information on how this parasite can spread.
Because it's a parasite and not a virus, it released spores, and those spores can last for extended periods of time. And with that many cases around, the risk of contamination is so high. And right now, we're not seeing any decrease in the number of cases.
And she added that these spores can transfer from one produce item to another. So wash everything. She says the friction of the water over the produce is all you need. I hope she's right. Joe Bruner from Channel 9, WSOC-TV. David Hodges from Channel 3, investigative reporter for WBTV. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Also with us today, Steve Harrison and Zachary Turner from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.